Hey guys, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems, and welcome to another edition of the MTB Strength Coach Podcast. It's been a little while since my last one. It's been actually over a month since my last podcast, but you know, what can I say? I'm a strength coach and a mountain bike rider, not one of these professional internet marketers that sits around all day in front of the computer. So anyways, and today I actually kind of want to do something a little different. I know the last few podcasts I've done have been a summary of the podcast and stuff, and I'll go over some of the things that I'd blogged about since my last podcast. But I also wanted to talk about a subject that comes up from time to time, particularly yoga, and you know how it kind of falls into your training program. And so anyways, I'll get to that here in just a second, but I wanted to kind of go over a couple of the blog posts I've made since my last podcast. And the first one is staying motivated to train. And you know, this is a question that I get a lot. You know, how do you stay motivated to keep training, especially when, you know, the weather's getting nicer and you're able to get out and ride more and stuff like that? You know, in the winter it can't, you know, it's a little easier because it gets dark earlier and you know, what the heck else are you going to do? So, you know, you can get a workout in, not that tough, but definitely a little tougher to stay motivated to train during the summer. And you know, my number one recommendation for this is nothing motivates like results. You know, really the hardest part is getting started and being consistent. Like you have to be consistent with your training for about 4 weeks to really start to see some significant results. You know, you'll definitely start to notice some things sooner than that. But as far as like, you know, wow, this is making a huge difference on my riding, you know, it takes about 4 weeks of being consistent. And, you know, once you see those results, then, you know, it's a lot easier to stay motivated to train. So, you know, it's just like anything else. The hardest part is getting the momentum going. And once you've got the momentum going, then it's a lot easier to keep that momentum going. So, you know, that's really my number one piece of advice, is just know that, you know, you're literally 4 weeks away from being a better mountain biker, guaranteed. You just need to be consistent and stick with your program for those 4 weeks. And, you know, I've mentioned this before. You know, me personally, I have trouble staying motivated to train during the summer as well. I'm not going to lie. You know, I'd much rather be out riding my bike. But, you know, when I start to slack off and, you know, I go a couple of weeks without training, you know, all of a sudden my lower back starts to get a little sore after a ride, and I got a left knee that, you know, starts talking to me again, and I just don't feel the same, you know, trail flow and just ability to, you know, attack and dominate, the trail like I usually do. And so, you know, that gets me back in the gym, man. And, you know, me personally, you know, that keeps me motivated, is when I start to see the drop off that I get from not training. And so anyways, like I said, there's no like quick and easy answer for that, but you know, you just got to know that you will be a better mountain biker for it. And if you really want to have as much fun on the trail as possible, then you have to train. It's not a matter of like, you know, it being a choice or not. Like, you cannot be the best rider that you can be without training, period. So, you know, if you want to be the best that you can be, then you know, train and see the results, and that'll keep you motivated. The next thing that I had talked about on my blog, I'd gotten a question from a newsletter reader, a blog reader, on core training and the draw-in. And for those of you that aren't familiar with this, the draw-in is it's kind of one of the first functional core training things that kind of, you know, started kicking off this whole core training and functional training craze. And basically, some researchers from Australia, you know, had done some research and it, you know, found out that, you know, certain deep abdominal muscles with people that have low back pain don't activate, versus people or people that have low back pain, those deep abdominal muscles don't activate. People that don't have low back pain, those deep abdominal muscles do activate, you know, shortly before movement, and it's almost like a pre-bracing thing with them. And so they had developed some training strategies, particularly what's known as the draw-in or thin tummy, where you try to, you know, draw your belly button in towards your spine. And that movement there engages those deep abdominal muscles that they were looking at. And so the draw-in started to become a extremely common functional core training method. But like many things, it kind of, there was an overreaction to it. And everybody was, doing this draw-in, and that was kind of the centerpiece for a lot of people's, core training movements. And so there's actually been some further research into it. And this person had forwarded me an article from New York Times blog talking about that the draw-in may actually be causing, some abdominal dysfunction, I guess, would be the word, because drawing your abs in is not actually what you want to do when you're trying to brace your core in order to create movement. And so, again, like I said, there's a guy named Mike Boyle who, really big influence on my career, and he probably put it best that, you know, if you have an athlete, and most mountain bikers are like this, they have weak lower abdominals, and they have kind of a distended lower abs, you know, like around the belly button region and below that kind of stick out a little bit. And so if you have someone who has this distended lower abdominal thing, then teaching them to draw the abs in is fine. You know, you are going to get some deep abdominal activation from that, and it will actually help bring your pelvis and bring your abs back to neutral, which is what you want. But you don't need to suck the abs in and get like really thin and drawn in. Like, you're not going to be able to move a lot of weight while trying to keep your abs drawn in extremely thin. And so I do use some draw-in exercises in my programming, basically because in my experience, most mountain bikers have that distended lower ab thing. And so you want to address that, and using some draw-in exercises will help with that. But the true thing that what you really want to accomplish is teaching your core to brace. Bracing is better than drawing in. So basically, the coaching cues that I use in my facility are telling people to lightly draw their belly button in and to lock their rib cage down to their pelvis. And that effectively gets their entire core engaged and ready to work. And so bracing and then moving is the key to core training. And so everything that you're doing can be core training if you're practicing this brace and then move philosophy. And so, again, my blog post, I said that this is a prime example of how people tend to overreact to things in the short term. You know, they overreacted, and all of a sudden everybody's drawing in for everything all the time. And we're going to end up underreacting to it in the long term. You watch, there's starting to be a backlash to this. And in another, 5 years or so, they're going to be talking about how you don't want to draw in and how that's actually bad. And so, again, somewhere in the middle is where we want to be. And so doing that is the best way to for core training. You know, using some of the draw-in to fix that distended lower ab thing, but, ultimately trying to teach your core to brace rather than just draw in. And so that's kind of the idea behind that, core training and the draw-in bit. And so, so that was another post that I had made there. And then next on the list here, we've got another article that had been forwarded to me by a newsletter reader. This is funny because I actually, probably like six people forwarded me this article. And it's basically, again, from the New York Times blog. And, the title of the article is "Can You Get Fit in 6 Minutes a Week?" And the point of the article was how interval training, has much of the same effects as aerobic training on your cardio capacity. And again, the whole idea behind aerobic base training was to increase your VO2 max, increase the volume of mitochondria, increase the capillary density, and then those things were going to help support your training as you started to move into more intense phases. And again, what this study showed was that they had one group that exercised for 5 to 9 minutes total, while the other group exercised for 5 hours total over the week, and yet their results were the same from a cardio training, from a cardio capacity standpoint. And more importantly, they observed the same molecular changes, including an increased volume of mitochondria. So again, you know, there's, as more and more evidence starts to come around, and we start to see more of what the true effects are of anaerobic intervals and you know, as opposed to aerobic base training, man, the deck is just getting really stacked against aerobic base training. Again, I know this is kind of one of those holy grails, and people just like, man, I don't understand that. How does something that I've been told since I was a kid not, you know, work like we've been told? And you know, I mean, at one time we thought the Earth was flat. I mean, we were convinced that the Earth was flat. And, you know, I guarantee you that as people started to try to propose the idea that the Earth wasn't flat, there was a lot of resistance to that, you know. And then you come to today, and it's like everyone just knows the Earth's not flat, it's round. So same thing with aerobic base training. Aerobic base training is the Earth is flat. And we're starting to find out that the Earth is not flat. There's a lot more to it than that. But there's just a lot of resistance because a lot of people have their entire training philosophy and identity wrapped up in the aerobic-based training, volume-based approach to, you know, to increasing your cardio capacity, despite the science. The science is there that shows us that is not the best, most effective, most time, you know, efficient way to train. And yet, you know, again, I know there's a lot of resistance out there to it, but again, this is just another article showing, like, how far ahead of the cardio training curve my stuff is. And again, I'm not tooting my own horn because I just steal stuff from guys a lot smarter than I am and bring it to you guys. But, you know, again, I guarantee you in 5 to 10 years, everyone's going to act like we knew this all along. And, you know, you guys can just laugh and say, man, you know, dude, I was doing this like 10 years ago, you know. I mean, what, you know, where were you 10 years ago when you were still jogging on a treadmill or putting 2 hours in on a road bike, you know? So anyway, staying ahead of the cardio training curve is kind of the point there. Got a couple videos posted, actually. I got a swing video posted on June 29th, an older video that I had shot. I like to go back. I've got some old YouTube videos that have been up for a few years, and every once in a while I like to post them and just kind of, you know, bring them back to the people's, you know, to the forefront of people's minds and stuff like that. Got some great pictures posted as well on July 1st from Decline Headquarters from my trip out to Southern California. You know, that place is just it's a museum, a bicycling museum. It's great, man. They got so many bikes and parts and so much cool old stuff. I mean, you know, I found a Z1 with a threaded steer tube. I mean, the fork that pretty much started the whole free ride revolution. So anyway, some cool picks there. Be sure to check that out. On July 2nd, I got a question, you know, how do I stop my calves from cramping? And this is a really common one, you know, calves cramping. And again, this, you know, we have to look at training from the perspective of you can either add positives or subtract from the negatives that are holding you back. You know, a good example is, you know, if you're driving down the road and you've got 1 foot on the gas and 1 foot on the brake, well, I mean, you can slam that gas down and you know, just keep pushing harder on the gas pedal, but until you take your foot off of the brake pedal, you're not going to get as far as you know, or get going as fast as you'd like. You know, a lot of times it's easier to just take your foot off the brake, and that's going to get you going faster. You don't even necessarily have to add anything. You don't even have to press down on the gas any harder. And so, anyways, the point is, a lot of times when people have an issue with a body part, for example, their calves are cramping, the automatic assumption is that the calves are too weak. and we need to do something, some sort of strengthening exercise or something like that in order to get them stronger, to keep them from cramping. And my take on it is that there's probably some negatives there that you need to take away before you start worrying about that. I guarantee that most bike riders do not do enough stretching and soft tissue work on their calves. And their calves are usually just this super tight ball of you know, trigger points and tight muscles. And that's going to cramp sooner than their regular, regular non-tight calves would. And so, again, just trying to strengthen them and add to the tension may actually make the situation worse. And so my answer is, if you've got a body part that tends to cramp on you sooner than other body parts, you need, I would guarantee you that that's probably too tight, and that you need to be concentrating on stretching and foam rolling and getting the tension levels down in that area before you need to worry about trying to make that area stronger. And so this is kind of a forgotten thing, man, like kind of a frontier that mountain bikers don't really take advantage of, is the use of that mobility and foam rolling stuff. And so, again, if you've got calves that tend to cramp on you, foam roll, use a tennis ball, stretch, you know, get them loosened up. And if you spend a good, you know, 3-4 weeks trying to get them loosened up and you haven't noticed any difference at all, then it may be time to say, okay, maybe I need to do some calf-specific strengthening. But, you know, odds are that's not the case. So calves from cramping, that's how you do that. On July 6th, I made a post on, you know, who do you blame? And, you know, the basic idea here is, you know, the mindset between different riders. And I've found, again, in my experience, there's two different kinds of riders out there. There's those that blame themselves, and there's those that blame their bike. And you can usually tell, you know, a lot of you that read this, I guarantee you that 90% of you guys blame yourself. Like, you recognize that you need to get better, you need to get fitter, you need to get stronger, you need to increase your skills. And that's why you guys read my blog and read my newsletter, because you're looking for ways to do that. But I realized that there's a lot of riders, in fact, I would say the majority of mountain bikers out there don't have that mindset. If they're not able to clean a climb, or, you know, they get tossed on a downhill section, or, you know, just whatever the case may be, they're going to blame their bike and say that, you know, it weighs too much, or the suspension isn't plush enough, or, you know, the fork doesn't have the right damping, or whatever the case may be. And, you know, that, you know, in my opinion, you know, that viewpoint, it's not totally mountain biker's fault. Cause, I mean, think about it. Most mountain bike magazines, you open them up, and, you know, 90% of them are dedicated to bike reviews and part reviews, and you've got all this advertisement trying to, you know, convince you that you need this part and that part. In fact, you know, kind of going off subject here, but in, you know, the last Decline magazine, they had an article on Steve Pete becoming the winningest World Cup racer in history. And, you know, congratulations to him, man. That dude's a freaking machine. I've had a chance to meet him once. Super nice guy, you know, and just a great mountain biker. I mean, you know, the guy's in his mid-30s and still able to, you know, win World Cup races. So, you know, a testament to him and his training program. But I'm looking through the magazine, and 661, who's his, you know, armor and pad sponsor, has an ad, and they're saying, you know, something like, you know, week after week, riders that trust the protection of 661 find themselves on a podium. I'm just like, are you serious? Are you kidding? Like, you just slap on 661 gear and you're a better rider? I mean, but that is the mentality that's just being drilled into people's heads. And so it cracks me up, and it makes me cry all at the same time, because it's so funny that people fall for that stuff. Like, you know, hey, you know, if I go out and I buy new 661 knee pads instead of these, you know, race face knee pads that I have, I'm going to be faster. Or, you know, I mean, that's a ridiculous train of thought, but that's what, you know, people get. And so you know, that train of thought is why people end up blaming their bikes and blaming their equipment instead of blaming themselves, because they're just not told. There's no good, you know, besides, you know, I mean, realistically, my blog and newsletter and now my articles I'm writing for Decline Magazine, there's not a whole lot of great training information for you guys out there. And so, anyways, the point is, you know, blaming your bike instead of yourself, you know, as I said in the blog post, it's a fool's quest. You know, your bike isn't the problem. The rider piloting the bike is. And so, you know, I give an example of, you know, a buddy of mine that doesn't train, and he's constantly blaming his bike or this part or that part for his woes on the trail. He reads every mountain bike magazine there is. He can tell you the difference between that part and this part and the other parts, and it's just like, dude, train, you know, do some freaking push-ups, do some one-legged squats, do some stretching, and see if that doesn't help you more than worrying about whether your, you know, your Fox 36 fork is holding you back compared to a RockShox Lyric, you know. I mean, seriously, who cares? That is not going to make that big of a difference on the trail. So anyway, I'm probably preaching in the choir here, so I'll get off of this little rant. But, you know, every day there's a chance to do something that will make you a better rider. So, you know, what did you do today that's going to make you a better rider tomorrow? And, you know, that's really the question that I have for you. On July 7th, I actually had an article that was posted on pinkbike.com. You know, if you guys have been following my stuff for a while, you'll recognize this article. It's one I've printed in a few places before, and but I was stoked that Pink Bike was interested in my stuff and was willing to print it. I will say I'm not sure exactly how it went. You know, I mean, people seem to enjoy it, and it got a pretty decent reaction. But again, it's just, man, I hate forums. I've got to tell you, I hate mountain biking forums, because, you know, people just take stuff, and it's called the straw man argument, you know, or all of a sudden they just like put up this straw man, like the stuff that you never said. Like, I had people coming on saying, like, you know, oh, why are you telling beginners to do this, that, and the other? And it's like, dude, nowhere in my article did I say this is a beginner program. Nowhere in my article did I say this is the ultimate riding program. This is just like a basic combination drill, you know. And so I got all these armchair strength coaches coming in, making these asinine comments about my article and stuff like that. And, you know, then I got to take time out of my day to go in and try and clear some of these things up, which just drives me nuts. So, you know, again, I try to be a nice guy. You know, like, I went in and somebody had posted something in the discussion forum about, you know, a basic workout they could use to get started. And, you know, I said, man, you know, go check out my bodyweight workout program. And, you know, he said he was going to do some jogging. And I was like, you know, jogging's probably not the best thing for you if you want to be a better mountain biker. You know, get stronger. You know, if you want to do some extra cardio, do some sprint intervals or something. And, you know, they'll help you trim up a little bit faster. And then, you know, again, I get some freaking dude coming in, and he's like, you know, you're straight up wrong, you know, and just, like, trying to call my advice out. Like, I don't know what the heck I'm talking about, you know. Of course, you check on his profile, and he's like some 21-year-old punk, you know, that doesn't know nothing about nothing when it comes to training people, but he's going to go on that forum and call me out. And it's just like, you know, what the heck's wrong with you people? You know, I'm sitting here trying to give you guys good, free advice, and I got to deal with idiots like that. So anyways, my point is, I enjoyed writing that article for Pink Bike. You know, I might post a couple more, I don't know. But, you know, that's one of the reasons, like, you guys don't see me in the forums. You know, I don't go to mtbr.com. I don't go to Ride Monkey. I don't go to nsmb.com. I don't waste my time on those places, because I would spend more time trying to defend crap that I never said to these armchair strength coaches that have never worked with anybody in their life. And, you know, it just kind of drives me nuts. So, anyways, that's why I kind of stick to my blog, stick to my newsletter. I talk to people that want my advice rather than, you know, trying to deal with people that, you know, would rather sit around and troll all day on the forums, which is pretty much what they do. Man, I swear, if half these guys spent, you know, even a quarter as much time training and riding their bike as they do posting about stuff, they'd be much better bike riders. So, you know, you guys know who you are. After that, I got posted a couple of great videos. One's a new one that I shot on the kettlebell swing for mountain biking. And much like the deadlift, which, you know, I've got a great video that breaks down how this teaches us our basic attack position on the bike and how it teaches you how to power movement with your hips and not just your quads. The swing is a great exercise for teaching us how to pop the hips to bunny hop and jump. And I can't tell you how big of a difference this exercise has made in my personal riding. And so, you know, I used to have, like most people, good days and bad days, especially when it came to jumping. You know, some days I just feel like, man, I'm just awesome. You know, this is great. I'm having so much fun. And then I would go back a couple days later and hitting the same jumps, and I'm just like, you know, feeling like I'm about to kill myself. And I hated that feeling of not knowing why am I going to kill myself today, whereas a couple days ago I felt great. And once I learned how to pop my hips instead of leaning back when I'm jumping and bunny hopping, everything changed. You know, my bunny hopping, especially at speed on the trail, being able to maintain speed and then pick the front wheel up and then hop up onto a rock and jumping, you know, when I start to have a bad jumping day, I just go back to my swing technique, pop my hips when going, you know, when popping off of the lip of the jump instead of leaning back, and all of a sudden I'm right back where I need to be. So the swing is one of those exercises that will totally change how you look at the trail once you get the movement pattern that we want behind it down, and then start learning how to apply that to the trail. So the swing is a great exercise. You should definitely check that video out if you haven't already, and start using it. You know, right after that, on the 14th, I posted a basic warm-up sequence for mountain biking. This is just one of the basic warm-up sequences that I use in my facility, and just shows you some different dynamic mobility moves that you can use to kind of loosen up different areas of the body. You know, this is what I run through something like this before working out. I've also will do this before I go and ride if I'm feeling tight and need some sort of warm-up. So another great video for you guys there. On the 15th, I got a good question about static stretching, and is it bad to stretch before a ride? And, you know, again, this is another one of those things that kind of drives me nuts, because, you know, yes, there were some studies that showed that, you know, static stretching decreased strength levels immediately after the stretching, which isn't necessarily bad. You know, I don't know. The whole point was is that it showed that stretching gets a muscle to relax and lengthen, you know, and, you know, a relaxed muscle is not going to produce tension as effectively as a muscle that has a little bit more tension and muscle tone. But, you know, what if we want to have a muscle lengthen and relax? And so anyways, you know, this guy that had asked me the question, he was, you know, doing some stretching, which, you know, good for him. I mean, come on, why are we going to discourage people from trying to do some stretching before they go and ride? Most people don't stretch before they ride, and to their detriment, I might add. So here's this guy, and he's making the effort to try and do some things, and he gets one of the, you know, his fellow riders in the group, and I'm sure that she meant well, but she comes up and tells him that he's all wrong, and that static stretching is for after the ride, and that dynamic stretching is before the ride, and then proceeded to show him what sounds like some pretty dynamic, almost bordering on ballistic type motions. You know, and then he added that she has a lot of credibility because she's a very strong rider. And so, you know, my answer had a couple parts. You know, basically one, something you guys may have heard me say before, if you hear somebody use the words always and never, it shows a lack of critical thinking skills. Okay, so I mean, even like myself, like I don't say that you should always do intervals and never do any sort of aerobic training. If that's what you hear, I apologize for that, but that's not what I say. You know, but when somebody says always and never, it shows that they don't know how to apply critical thinking skills to training situations, because, you know, that's never, almost never the case there. You know, using, you know, there's always some scenario where you might want to use something. So, you know, there were some studies that showed immediately after static stretching, you know, strength and power levels were decreased, but it doesn't tell us that we shouldn't stretch before a ride. You know, you know, and the example I use in the blog post is that, you know, if your hip flexors are chronically tight and short, which most mountain bikers are, that's going to inhibit your glutes, which means that you're not going to be able to effectively use your hips to power your pedaling efforts. So it results in decreased hip power, which takes away from overall pedaling power. So if you do some static stretching for the hip flexors and you get them to relax and lengthen, you'll actually increase your hip mobility and you'll make it easier to contract your glutes, which will lead to better, more efficient positions on your bike and increased pedaling power. So again, if you can critically apply what we learned from the study, you can find ways to you know, improve your riding through static stretching before a ride. And so, you know, another thing to keep in mind is those studies looked at the effects immediately after stretching. We have no idea what the effects were later on. So to say that doing some static stretching before a ride is going to negatively affect you like 30 minutes or 60 minutes or more into the ride is a wild guess at best, because nobody knows. So again, you know, static stretching before a ride, saying that it is never a good idea is just not true. You know, I mean, obviously I would say that like a four-cross rider or a downhill rider, you know, may benefit from, you know, more dynamic mobility and a little less static stretching before, you know, a race or something like that. But for your average trail rider, for your average cross-country rider, doing some static stretching before a ride is not going to, you know, cause that many problems, if any problems at all. Now, I will say that dynamic mobility does have a place in a pre-ride or workout routine. And you know, if you watch that warm-up video that I posted before this post here, you'll see that I do use dynamic mobility a lot before I work out. But I do also recommend doing some static stretching. Like, basically, when someone comes into my facility to work out, I first have them get on a foam roller and hit their quads and hip flexors and basically their whole lower body, just get the tension levels down. And then I have them do some static stretching for the quads and hip flexors and chest, as these muscles tend to be short and tight. And then I use dynamic mobility movements after that to help, you know, get that overall dynamic mobility that we're looking, that's a little more specific to working out. So again, you know, use everything to your advantage. Like, why just limit yourself to one or the other when you can use both and create a more effective warm-up program? And so, you know, in the blog post, I give some advice on a couple moves that you can use from that dynamic mobility video that I had posted, you know, before a ride, something real quick. You know, like I said in the post, man, both methods are simply tools in our toolbox, and knowing how each tool works and how to best apply it is the real trick to creating a good training program. You know, and, you know, a couple other points that I made in the post, you know, not to sound mean, but I guarantee you that if that person had asked his friend, how did she come to that conclusion, I'll guarantee you that she has never looked at the studies, she has never analyzed the studies, she has no clue what they actually tell us. She is simply parroting back something that she read or heard without any question or thought as to why that was the conclusion. And I'm not saying that it's bad to take, because like I said, I basically read and listen to a lot of guys smarter than me, and, you know, then I apply what they have to say, and if it works, then I bring it to you guys. But I don't take much of anything on face value. You got to question everything. And if you come to the same conclusion after you question it, then great. But a lot of times, you don't. A lot of times, the stuff that you read in the fitness media is driven more by marketing and sensationalism than through the results that you're going to get from it. So, you know, again, I got mentioned before, you know, I call these people armchair strength coaches. You know, they've never worked with anyone besides themselves, and they simply repeat popular opinion on training without any critical thought or real experience in its application. And, you know, like I mentioned earlier, these people populate most mountain biking forums, which is why I don't waste my time posting on them, because it is impossible to argue with somebody that is simply reading back to you out of some magazine or manual that they have without ever having experienced it beyond what they themselves, you know, have tried and used. And the other thing that I pointed out, you want to be careful giving strong riders too much credibility with training advice. Now, here's the deal. I was thinking about this because this is a, you know, a question for me. You can't, I will admit, you can't argue with results. Okay, if somebody's done something and gotten great results with it, great. You can't argue with their results. But there's a difference between training insight and training advice. Okay, great riders may have some training insight, but I would be really hesitant to take too much of it as straight up advice. And you know, the example I use in my blog post is, you know, one of the top U.S. cross country riders. I was talking with him about nutrition, and he made a comment, "Oh man, nutrition doesn't matter." He's like, "You know, man, I had my best race at a national after eating some Taco Bell." Okay, he won a national cross country race. He had one of the best results of the year that year. I don't think that means that Taco Bell is the best pre-ride meal for everybody. So, you know, this is a good example of training insight versus training advice. And so you certainly want to talk to and learn from strong riders, riders that have a lot of experience. But again, you know, you have to understand that a lot of times super talented riders succeed despite what they do. And this is a prime example, man. Most people would blow up after eating Taco Bell, all right? So he actually succeeded despite what he did, not because of what he did. And so, again, learn how to differentiate between training insight and training advice when looking at what top riders do would serve all of us, you know, well. And so, anyway, so a couple subjects in that post there. Getting down to the nitty-gritty last few things, and we'll be caught up here on my blog post. You know, I made a post on the 20th. Is mountain bike racing and mountain biking the same thing? And, you know, I just gotten back from Nationals, and I'd seen some of the top riders in the U.S., you know, just killing it. It was great to see guys at this level riding. But, you know, something I've been thinking about for a while is, like, you know, the disconnect that you get sometimes between mountain biking, which is what most of us do. We, you know, we may race, but it's not, like, super hardcore part of our identity. You know, we like to go out and ride trail, you know, basically get the soul food that mountain biking delivers. But then you've got people that are racing is their mindset. And again, I'm not judging either way. These are just some thoughts that I have on mountain biking and stuff like that. But, you know, I had a couple of, you know, examples here. Like, you know, for example, if you've got a section on a cross country course where it's faster to get off and run than it is to pick your way through it, and there's no penalty for dismounting, is that really mountain biking? You know, I don't know. Or when you've got a kid, and I, you know, we're seeing way more of this one here, which really kind of disturbs me. But, you know, you get a kid who gets directly into downhilling or downhill racing. They have no ability to pedal a bike up anything. They cannot even ride down a regular trail without at least 7 inches of suspension on their bike. You know, is that really mountain biking? You know, again, I don't know. Or, you know, the other thing is when you get a guy who comes from a BMX background and he can rip a BMX-inspired mountain cross track, but he doesn't do as well on, you know, a more mountain bike-inspired course, and he doesn't get out on the trail and ride. You know, he's pretty much just a dirt jump, bike park, you know, four cross rider. You know, is that really mountain biking? You know, and so, I don't know. You know, like I said, I'm a former track athlete. I know the thrill of lining up and racing and seeing who's the best on that day, and I can certainly appreciate that. But, you know, I believe that there is mountain biking has a way. And, you know, maybe the way reveals itself differently to everybody. But, you know, I just feel like if you really want to understand mountain biking and appreciate it on all levels, you know, you don't pigeonhole yourself, you know. Like, even if you're a cross-country rider, you still want to know how to navigate technical downhill sections. If you're a downhill racer, you know, you still want to be able to ride a trail with less than 7 inches of suspension or be able to, like, you know, pedal your bike up stuff. If you're a, you know, a four cross or mountain cross specialist, you know, you'd still do well to get out on the trail and learn some basic trail skills. I think that expanding those, expanding your riding and expanding your perception of what you need as a rider will help you in your chosen discipline. So anyways, this is kind of my thoughts on it. You know, I had a few people come on and post some comments on that, so it must have struck a chord there. But yeah, you know, good stuff there. Just some food for thought. See here, on the 22nd, I posted a review. I'm going to start doing some reviews, you know, stuff I like. I ride, you know, I got stuff that I like, equipment that's done well for me, and give you guys some real life reviews on stuff, not, you know, things that you know, were you know, people have been sent product and in hopes of a good write-up. You know, this is stuff that I've paid for out of my own pocket, stuff that I use, and stuff that I like. And so the first thing that I talked about was my 510 sticky rubber shoes. You know, read the story on how I came about it. But, you know, if you're still out there trying to, you know, ride platform pedals on just regular skate shoes or something like that, man, you're missing out. There's a whole another world of traction and security on your pedals that can be gained through the sticky rubber shoes. You know, I definitely like the 510s and give them my thumbs up. And then last but not least here, getting to the end of the blog post, is I had made a post a little while back on the benefits of unilateral training, and one of my regular readers had sent me a question, a really good question actually, you know, given all the benefits of unilateral training, why would you want to use bilateral training? And, you know, to be honest with you, that's something I've thought myself, you know. But there are some things I think that bilateral training gives us, you know, and specifically, you can expose your body to higher intensity levels, you know, basically weight, with bilateral training than you can with unilateral training. And it's usually more than just your unilateral training weight times two. And the example I gave is, if you can single leg squat with 50 pounds, you're freaking strong. That's a strong single leg squat. And I guarantee you that you can front squat with two legs far more than just 100 pounds, you know. So there are intensity levels that you're going to be able to expose your body to that you're not going to be able to effectively get with unilateral training. And I do think that there are some benefits to that. And one of the things, actually, I think that not a lot of people have thought about, those high max tension levels that you have to generate in your body to brace yourself for these heavy bilateral, especially lower body movements, can help you better learn how to brace yourself for a fall. Like, I've looped out a couple times and just blasted myself into the ground, and I guarantee you that the heavy deadlifts that I do, you know, I felt my body just tense up. It felt like a heavy deadlift, you know, the tension levels that I created right before I hit the ground. And I guarantee you that my body being exposed to and learning how to generate those max tension levels helped keep me from getting hurt on some of those things. So, you know, that's one of the benefits right there. And, you know, again, just kind of using logic, like one of the guys, the guy Mike Boyle, strength coach out of Boston that I mentioned before, he's one of the guys who's really championed the use of unilateral training. And even he sees a benefit too and uses bilateral exercises. Like the front squat is a staple of, you know, his program. So, you know, if a guy like Mike Boyle uses deadlifts, uses front squats, you know, then I think that they definitely have something to offer us as well. So I think that the point is to limit the use of bilateral training and to make sure that you're including a heavy dose of unilateral work, especially for the lower body. And I did also point out, and this is, again, one of those things, like, this is the difference between someone like me who actually coaches people and works with real people versus you know, these people on the internet who've never worked with anyone and are basically, you know, reporters on methods more than people who've actually used them. But the other thing is time. You know, when you're using exclusively unilateral exercises, then you start to run out of time. And so, you know, I personally use bilateral exercises to kind of keep the time frame down. I mean, you know, we've only got so much time to train. For upper body stuff, I use a lot of alternating reps where you know, do one side and then the other and just repeat back and forth for the prescribed number of reps. And I save my true unilateral training for my lower body exercises. And again, that just kind of helps keep the time frame under control. I mean, it's really easy if you use a lot of unilateral stuff for your workouts to all of a sudden, you know, realistically take an hour and a half or more to complete, which just isn't going to happen for most people. So in trying to keep things in a reasonable time frame, that's another reason that you would want to include some bilateral training there. So, all right. So anyways, well, that's pretty much it. Kind of gets us caught up on the blog posts and stuff that I've made since the last podcast. And I know I mentioned earlier in the podcast that I was going to go over yoga. But I see that this is actually starting to approach the 45 plus minute mark. And so getting a little long on this podcast. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to wrap up this podcast, and then I'm going to do another one, or maybe shoot a video here and in the next day or two, get something up covering the subject of yoga and, you know, how you can, you know, effectively fit it into your program. And I'll tell you right now, I think yoga has some benefits, but it is not the end-all, be-all training method that a lot of people will have you believe. And, you know, at a certain point, it does start to have drawbacks. And so, you know, just like anything else, learning how to recognize those drawbacks and learning how to minimize them is what you want to do. So hopefully I can help you guys get a little bit better understanding of what some of those drawbacks are and how you can more effectively integrate yoga into your training program. So anyways, once again, this has been James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems. If you guys got any questions or comments on any of this stuff, go to my blog at bikejames.com. You can find these posts, you know, post a comment. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Yeah, hopefully you guys have enjoyed this. And I plan on trying to be a little more consistent. I was pretty consistent there, like doing one a week there for a while before I let this last, you know, time lapse go. So I'll try to be a little more consistent with these guys going in the future. But anyways, once again, appreciate all you guys. MTB Strength Training Systems would be nothing without you guys. You know, I do this for you. I just want to help you guys have more fun on your bike. So hopefully this podcast, my blog in general, and all of my efforts are helping you do that. So enjoy your next ride, and I'll talk to you next time.